Before we start talking on today's reading, I thought I would mention a couple of things I encountered yesterday in the real world that are somewhat relevant to this course. I'm having a dental implant put in, replacing a tooth that died. And as one minor step of it yesterday, they were taking a three-dimensional picture of the inside of my mouth. So people who are doing 3D printing, the scanning, the other side of that is already there. It's already there in, you know, expensive machines used by dental surgeons. But they're actually putting something into your mouth, which has got a camera and it's got a cable connecting you to a computer, and they do a series of pictures, and there on the screen is the three-dimensional image of the teeth around the tooth that they're doing things with, which they want to have so they can make the prosthetic. And, you know, you can rotate it and see it and all of that. So that I thought was really quite neat, that there it is in the real world. But it also occurred to me as sort of a more general issue, which is somewhat related to IP issues. And that was the question that I wondered about, was whether there were any ways in which the dental implant was inferior to the original tooth. Because on the face of it, you know, tooth teeth are a nuisance. You keep having cavities filled and stuff like that. And here is a, I guess it's metal covered by, I don't know, enamel or something. And it looks the same. And nothing goes wrong with it. And I couldn't get the dental surgeon, the closest he could come would say it wasn't aesthetically as attractive as the natural tooth. So the question I was putting was, suppose it didn't cost anything. Suppose we didn't have the monetary and time and all the rest cost. Would the right thing to do when you reach adulthood just be remove all your teeth and replace them in dental implants? And, yeah? Yes. So that could be a possible. The thing is, my general assumption is that evolution has got better technology than we do, and that therefore, as a general rule, prosthetics are inferior to the original. And the interesting question is, since its technology is holding fixed and ours is getting better, are we beginning to approach the point where we can actually improve on nature rather than just have inferior substitutes? Yeah? Well, eventually. That is obviously one. I don't know if any of you remember, there used to be a TV series, The $6 Million Man. And it was wrong. But it was wrong. And the idea was somebody who'd suffered some sort of terrible accident, and at a great expense, $6 million doesn't seem that much anymore, but it did then, they put him back together as sort of a Superman, that he's got, you know, artificial legs, I don't know what, his legs, arms, everything, which result in his being much stronger and faster and all the rest of it. And it's pretty clear that at the time that was done, that just wasn't true, that, you know, you had prosthetic devices, which were sort of imperfect, but nothing as good as the original, let alone better. On the other hand, it's not logically impossible, and there may be some interesting IP implications as we move towards that. Now, of course, there are two different strategies, which is sort of interesting. One of the strategies is that one, and the other strategy is learning enough biology so that we can use the biological technology to do it, to regrow teeth instead of doing implants. And, you know, presumably we aren't that far from being able to regrow your heart, say, or because, you know, each cell has got all the DNA information. You just have to know how to use it. So at some point, instead of having transplants, you will be producing your own organ to replace the defective one, and that presumably is going to work much better. And then, of course, you'll get into the question, at what point does that mean we can abolish aging? At what point you regrow everything bit by bit, as it were? And that would be very interesting. If people are sufficiently curious, my book, Future Imperfect, you can read from my webpage. You don't even have to pay Amazon to get a copy. And one of the things that I discuss is what the world is like if we end aging. That after all, everyone in this room is dying of an incurable disease, which has killed everybody before us, right? Old age. There is no a priori reason why that disease is incurable. If you sort of just think of the logic of it, the information to reconstruct your body is in every cell of your body. It's massively redundant. You can't lose it. Therefore, if we only knew enough, you could rebuild everything, which would be very nice. And I should say, my own guess is that none of you is going to die of old age. I probably will. My guess is you won't. But that's 50-50. Better than 50-50 chance, I think we solve that problem before you get old. We'll see. Anyway. All right. Let me, as usual, start by asking whether you have any questions about what we did last week. There were, I think, a number of interesting things we never got to. One of the things I had on my outline that we never got to is that if you look at the readings we are doing, there is a sense in which all of them are apologetics for current law. all of them sort of take it for granted that the existing legal rules for copyright are more or less right, and then ask why they're right. And it's not clear that one ought to accept that. It's not, you know, I don't have any good theory which tells me that either judges or legislatures get the law right. So you could imagine variants of the law in any direction. You could say, suppose we had copyright law and had no doctrine of fair use. And suppose that was what you were used to. I bet you could write a good law review article proving that was the right solution. As good as the ones proving the present one is. Ditto the other way around. Suppose we had what I'm actually, I think, inclined to favor, which is a much more limited version of copyright protection, so that you can't copy my book, but if all you want to do is copy a couple of paragraphs, you don't need my permission. If you want to do a sequel, you don't need my permission, even though it'll irritate me when you do, because you'll get it wrong, and so forth. And again, I think if that was the rule, I think I could write an article showing that that was right, and that this crazy proposal to include derivative works was just a nuisance and so on. But I think it's worth thinking about in all of this stuff that there's a pretty strong prejudice in people writing about the law to more or less take for granted what exists and to suggest sort of minor tweaks to it. This, in a sense, struck me a long time ago within the economic analysis of law, because as some of you may know, Judge Posner, who was one of the sort of founding writers in the field, offered this conjecture that the common law can best be understood as a set of economically efficient rules, as a set of rules designed to maximize the size of the pie. And it was a very interesting conjecture, and it got us thinking about a lot of interesting questions. But it's not clear it's true. And there's no good theoretical argument, I don't think, for it. It's really an empirical argument. And the trouble with the empirical argument when you really go through it is that what Posner and other people do is they say, well, here is some legal issue. Here is what the law says the rule is. Here is why that's economically the right answer. And there's at least one case that I've pointed out where you have legal rules where in two different parts of the law where the economics are exactly the same. You have the opposite rule in the two areas. And in each case, Posner has shown why it's the economically efficient rule without, I think, realizing they were the same argument. And that the problem is that a lot of the time, the arguments are flexible enough so that you've got two alternative rules. You can make an argument for this. You can make an argument for that. If you know what the rule is, you've got a prejudice in favor of making the argument in one direction. And I think the same pattern exists in a lot of other contexts. I mean, I've been arguing for a while on the whole global warming stuff, that what's really going on is we don't know whether global warming has good or bad effects, because it has both. But if you start out knowing it has bad effects, you're only looking for them. If you start out knowing it's good effects, you're only looking for them. And so you persuade yourself that you have an objective argument for whatever you already believe. And I think that's true in a lot of stuff, and it's a pattern one ought to watch out for in oneself, because we all do it. I mean, I do it too. All right. So having said that, then do you have questions for the reading for today, or comments, or criticisms, or anything else? Yes. Yeah, as long as there are ideas with relevant to this chapter, the ideas that are irrelevant to the chapter only after we run out of the chapter and have time left. I think we want to structure it to some extent, though not completely. Yeah. It seems to me there are a number of interesting issues that. I was going to start out by saying that I hope you people concluded, as I did reading this chapter, that trademark was more interesting than you thought it was going to be. Because it actually does involve some intellectually intriguing questions. One of them is distinction between theory of confusion and theory of dilution. That you really have two conceptually different bases, and it sounds as though at the very beginning it wasn't clear what it was going to be. It then became pretty clearly theory of confusion, and then later on people started introducing into law theory of dilution. The question of just under the theory of confusion, what gets covered? So that the whole distinction between descriptive and arbitrary marks, that if I say, you know, my beer is made from pure water, I almost certainly cannot protect that. If it's called pure water beer, maybe I can protect that. And the reasons for that, and those get into some of the same issues we've been talking about. I mean, in general, as we'll be seeing today, a number of the underlying issues are really issues we've been through three or four times already in patents and copyright. It's more closely related. But then another question, which is sort of interesting, is how going from trademark to trade dress affects it. That in a sense, the shape of the Coke bottle is just as much a trademark as Coca-Cola is. All right? I don't know if it still is true, but certainly it was true for a long time that there was a glass bottle of a particular shape, which is what Coke used, and I don't think it had any special functional advantages, but you could recognize it. And then the question is, should the rights you get over identifying your product when you do it by trade be different from the ones when you do it by a name, and if so, why? And I think that sort of is an interesting set of questions. And there's the question of how it all interfaces with the First Amendment, because after all, what is trademark doing? It's restricting other people's use of language. Well, that's what First Amendment is supposed to not let you do. So all of that is intriguing, and other things as well. And one thing which sort of occurred to me as an intriguing example of the issues in an odd context is an author's name. All right. Suppose who wrote the Harry Potter books? J.K. Rowling. All right. Very, very famous now. Very successful. Suppose somebody else whose name happens to also have the same initials and be Rowling, and who has no particular talent, hires a ghostwriter to write a book in the same genre, relying on the fact that the name on that book will be J.K. Rowling. All right. Is that a violation of trademark? Should it be? It's his own name. Let me give you a number of real cases, not, which don't involve as far as I'm paying attention. You may not be aware of it, but there are two Winston Churchills. If you start looking up stuff by Winston Churchill, there is one Winston Churchill who was one of the most famous 20th century politicians, Prime Minister of England during World War II. But there is an American novelist, and I'm not sure he may even be a distant relation because I guess not, because Churchill's mother was American, his father wasn't. But also named Winston Churchill, and apparently a fairly successful novelist. You know, I'd never heard of him until I came across him because I was looking for the other Winston Churchill. Well, it's hard to argue that either of them was violating anything, and yet, you know, you identify authors by their names. But then I was thinking of my case. It happens that there is a famous musician called David Friedman. I know this because I do web searches to see if people are talking about me and what they're saying, and I come across other David Friedmans in the process. Well, does he have a claim against me or do I have a claim against him? I don't think so. On the other hand, there's also an economic journalist called David Friedman, who I don't know very much about. But I suspect that I am actually injured by him and he's actually injured by me. That is to say that there are occasionally people who read something by him and assume it's by me and therefore attribute his views to me, and I think they're different from mine from the little bits I've seen of his. And there may be people who read something by me and attribute my views to him, ditto. So that you really do have an actual possibility of confusion there, existing unintentionally. I mean, I assume neither set of parents were deliberately trying to create confusion, but one which is, in a sense, analogous to some of the issues that we're talking about here. So I guess one question you think was a legal issue is, suppose it was clear that the confusion was deliberate. Take my J.K. Rowling and add the one more detail that the author's original name used to be Robinson. And so he or she goes into court and has a name change to Rowling, happens to have J.K. as the initials, and then had no plans to write books before the Harry Potter books became successful. It turns out, got a ghostwriter to write the book. Now you begin to suspect, well, maybe that really is deliberate deception and maybe ought to be illegal. All right. But I think that example sort of suggests some of the issues. So suppose we start out with the theory of confusion. And that's a pretty simple theory, right? The basic idea is that the problem is that you're fooling consumers into thinking that the product is a different product than it really is. It's not quite that simple, but we can start out that way. And then there are going to be two interesting questions. One of them is what kind of trademark can be protected under those circumstances, and the other is who can be protected against. So that, for example, Lexus automobiles, is clearly a trademark. It's a fairly valuable trademark. If somebody brought out a car and they labeled it Lexus L-E-X-I-S, they would presumably be violating trademark. Does it follow that if somebody has a database of legal information labeled Lexus, L-E-X-I-S, that they are infringing? Or if, I don't know who had it first, but whichever one had it first, is that a conflict? And the immediate answer to that question is no, because there's no likelihood of confusion. Right? That's sort of been the standard argument. But I think it gets a little bit trickier the more you think about it. And I want to take the case which is not so obvious, which is Aunt Jemima. And that is, Aunt Jemima is a brand of pancake batter. Somebody brings out Aunt Jemima maple syrup. Well, does that... And I think there are two arguments against it. One argument is that buyers may say, I really like their pancake batter, so this is obviously their maple syrup. After all, maple syrup is connected to pancakes. Therefore, I'll buy it. So that's a confusion. And the other point, which sort of expands maybe the rights of the holder a little bit, is that the problem really isn't only confusion in a positive sense. The problem isn't only that the consumer will buy something he thinks is good and isn't. It's also that the consumer will buy something he thinks by Aunt Jemima and not like it, and then lower his opinion of their pancake batter. All right? That there's... I mean, it's sort of an interesting question. You might say at first, well, why should it matter? Why should, even if it was by the same company, there are different products? But the real answer, I think, is that most of us believe that some companies are more competent than others. Some more nearly fit our tastes, right? If you think about differing styles of whether writing or cars or whatever else, and you say, my wife likes to claim that she always prefers to buy Japanese cars. Why? Because Japanese cars are designed for the elderly engineers who are at the top of the hierarchy, and they're all short. All right. Japanese aren't anymore all short. I remember my father commenting when he visited Japan, you know, like 40 years ago or 50 years ago, that it was the only country he'd ever been in where he was a tall man. He's about my height, roughly. And it doesn't work anymore. That was, I think, though I'm not sure, it wasn't genetics. It was just malnutrition, especially during World War II, but to some extent before that, because it was a relatively poor country, and it's not a poor country anymore. So the result is that the people who are designing the cars are short, so they make cars that are comfortable for short people. We're short people, therefore we like Japanese cars. Won't be true in another generation, probably, but good things pass. But in any case, but that's sort of one example where you'd expect correlations across products and more generally in quality. And not only in quality in the sense of good-bad, but also different people like different sorts of things. So you might say, well, this company is really good at making flashy, up-to-date, high-status things, and I really like that. Other people will say, no, I mean, when I go to a restaurant, if anything, the fact that restaurant looks fancy is a negative, because that means they're spending their money on decor instead of food. So I really like, if anybody wants a good, inexpensive meal, there's two nice, small Korean restaurants, both on Saratoga Avenue, one just north of 280, and one maybe a mile or two south of 280, that we've eaten at, and they're inexpensive, and it's good Korean food, and they're not quite greasy spoons, but they certainly are not high decor restaurants. You want high decor, good food. Mint, which is our favorite local Indian restaurant where we ate last night. I think there's some there are also Indian restaurants that fit our usual pattern, but Mint is, they've got white tablecloths and they make it all look nice. And they're more expensive than the Korean, but they're not really expensive. It's very good Indian food. Recommendations. Free information. Public good being produced. They haven't even paid me to advertise them. Which does raise, incidentally, an interesting point that had occurred to me, which is to wonder how much of the whole discussion changes or ought to change as a result of the Internet. Because there's a sense in which you think of sort of advertising and trademark and all of that as mechanisms for spreading information. We have a much more powerful technology for spreading information than we used to have. It's one we use pretty routinely. When we're looking for a new restaurant of some sort, we go up on the web and you see what the reviewers' comments are. And you know some of them might be bogus, but you can usually, I think, tell the difference between this is wonderful, 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 which was written by the people who run the restaurant, and I really like their A and B, but their C is pretty poor, which is written by a real customer. So that's sort of another interesting question. But anyway, going back to the question of the non-competing goods, you do have the issue, which is getting a little bit towards dilution, though it isn't quite, which is that if the customer doesn't know, even if the goods aren't competing, if somebody else brings a fake Aunt Jemima pancake mix, that hurts Aunt Jemima in two ways. One of them is people buy that instead of theirs, even though they've gone to all the trouble of establishing, I don't know if they're particularly good or not, but suppose they are, of establishing their reputation. And the other problem is that their reputation goes down because the other people are making lousy pancake mix. But if somebody brings out Aunt Jemima maple syrup, that doesn't cut into the direct sales. It's not competing. It's a non-competing product, which is the standard term. But because the customers don't know it's non-competing, or say don't know it's non-competing, they know it's non-competing, they don't know it's by a different firm, it therefore lowers the firm's reputation. And that's a little bit towards dilution, except that as far as I can tell, the dilution doctrine holds that even when the customers do know it's a different firm, there's still a problem. And that's sort of an interesting kind of having to do almost with the technology of how people think or the technology of language or something like that, which I thought was actually quite intriguing. Yeah?
Is that sort of assuming that people won't differentiate between that one company can have a good product and a bad product?
What I was saying is what they're assuming, not they won't differentiate at all, but that they believe there's correlation. That was the point I was making before in my case of the Japanese cars as sort of a trivial example, that we believe that different cars made by the same company are or are not likely to be suitable for short people because we suspect that there's something in the social, in the history of the people running designing the cars that affects that. And I think there is a general tendency, it may be a mistake sometimes, but there's a general tendency to assume that if you've gotten a good product of one sort, I sort of assume that since I think highly of Apple Macintosh computers, probably that means that the routers, the overpriced routers they sell, are probably also pretty good routers. And therefore, if I'm willing to pay the money, it may save the trouble of having problems with routers that might not be as good. Now, on the other hand, I use an Android phone, so it's not like it's 100%. But my guess is that probably the iPhone is probably a pretty high-quality product. Yeah.
Yeah. I think from a food perspective, uh-huh. There's plenty of places I'll go to where I really like one thing that they make.
And yes.
If you venture into something else and you really dislike it, it doesn't necessarily bring down the whole reputation of the restaurant. It just means that you sort of stick back.
But might you, the question is, wouldn't your guess in that case be, it's not that they make something badly, it's just the kind of thing you don't like. So if you had a friend, if you said, well, you know, I like their barbecued, their spare ribs. I don't like their chili. And a friend says, well, I really like chili. Maybe I should try it. And you say, well, yeah, you know, they probably make pretty good chili. I just don't like chili. Right? Isn't it, you think that's more likely than that you would say, well, they're really competent on one and incompetent on the other? I'm thinking I should say of a real example with our Indian restaurant, because they had a dish which I think they've taken off the menu now, which was eggplant with some kind of peanut stuff, which sounded really good and was really bad. But I think we later tried a different eggplant that replaced it, and that was pretty good. So my guess is they just made a mistake. Yeah.
I think it's more the other way where this is like, the example is like, so I'll go to a restaurant with me and my girlfriend, and she, like a burger place or something
yeah.
like that. And it's supposed to be really good for burgers, but yeah. she doesn't like red meat, so she wants to get the veggie burger, something
right.
like that. Obviously, that's something I feel like they include on the menu. Just to appease, and that's not
yes.
really their specialty.
Yes. So might be some such cases, but all the argument really requires is there's some correlation. That everything else being equal, the fact you like one dish in a restaurant gives you a higher guess at the others, even though you realize it may turn out not to be true. And that therefore, even if Aunt Jemima maple syrup is terrible, it probably isn't even made from maple syrup. It's probably maple flavor and, you know, corn syrup or something. I don't know if that's true, but let me guess that's true. Because usually, in fact, probably if you really look carefully, they probably don't even let it call it maple syrup. They probably call it maple flavored syrup or something. Because the real maple syrup you get up in Vermont and places like that, it comes out of trees. Boiled down a lot. It seems to me that to some extent you are going to lower the opinion of the firm. And that certainly there are some firms which I feel good about dealing with in the sense that I've had good experiences in one respect, so they're probably good people in other respects. I just encountered sort of a what struck me is a fairly striking example on the question of firm reputation, which is that a couple of years ago, I got a knife sharpener, a very high-end expensive knife sharpening kit, sharpening kitchen knives, with, you know, diamond abrasives and stuff, and fairly ingeniously. And it was clearly a neat design, but it had a problem. And I mentioned, I think, one of the pieces broke. And they promptly sent me for free a replacement. They found it had a problem, too, and they'd replaced that piece with a better version of that piece, sent it to me for free. And a week ago, I think, I emailed them saying, you know, I still like your product, but here are a couple of small problems I've had with it. What do I get back? Yes, we've improved both of those features. We're sending you free replacement parts. So that was a case where the original piece was overpriced, in my view. It cost a good deal more than I would expect it to. But the alternative, the part of what I was paying for, it turns out, is that they really stand behind their product in a stronger way than you usually expect people to stand behind their product. So they have a good reputation, and if I discovered that company was making something else I wanted, I'd be tempted, even if it was high priced, to get it on those grounds. Different question, though. Assuming our theory is misleading customers, should trademarks be transferable? All right. Suppose that the firm that makes Aunt Jemima pancake mix also makes a bunch of other things, for all I know they do, and they decide that really they're doing better on the other things. They're going to go out of the pancake mix marker, but they've got this valuable trademark. Should they be allowed to sell to another food company the right to make Aunt Jemima pancake mix? Yeah?
Well, I think that they should be allowed to if they keep, like, everything in the recipe and stuff the same. But I still think the consumer is entitled to know that.
The problem with that is that you wouldn't impose that same requirement if they don't sell it, right? Presumably producers can change their formulations. They do it from time to time as they think something is better or less expensive or whatever. So other people? Because it does strike me as the sort of thing where we take it for granted you can sell trademarks. And you can make arguments for selling, but it's not as obvious as it first seems. Because, yeah?
I would say no to the flat claim of trademark properties.
Yep.
Because the dilution theory is just that once you sell it, the consumers don't know what's really going on.
But that's not the dilution theory. We've got to be careful because these terms are being used as technical terms. And the dilution is I think, at least from the readings here, is the case where Company B uses the same label as Company A. Everybody knows they're different companies and different products, but it still lowers the value of that label. So, which is an interesting phenomenon, and I think it's real, even though it seems sort of crazy, that words have a sort of penumbra to them, as it were. And the one of the cases that struck me, there is a company in San Jose called Cadillac Plastics. All right. I presume they have, I would be astonished if they had any connection to the makers of Cadillac cars. And it wouldn't astonish me if the guy who founded it happened to be named Cadillac. I don't know if it was deliberate or not. But nonetheless, there is a sense in which Cadillac is taken as a shorthand for high quality. All right. It was for a long time the top U.S. Made auto brand, pretty much. And then there are a couple of arguments for why maybe the car company should have some rights over that. Maybe it shouldn't. But one argument is that if it really turns out to be lousy plastic, even though people shouldn't make that conclusion, they will somehow feel that the shine is off the Cadillac name and maybe I'm going to get, you know, a Lincoln Continental instead. And the other argument that could be made, at least by an economist, is, well, look, Cadillac, by establishing the meaning of this word, has produced something useful. They've improved the language. They've added a new word, which is sort of shorthand for quality. They should be able to collect the revenue from that. How do they do that? By licensing the use of the word. This is getting back. I don't know if any of you remember, but at the very beginning of the semester, when we had the readings from my Law's Order book, one of the questions that I found sort of fun to think about was, what if you turn the English language into private property? And that's coming back here, because trademarks are one very narrow sense in which, to a little bit, English language is private property. And it's becoming more private property on the dilution theory than on the misleading theory, because it then covers, even when you're not misleading people. And you have arguments for and against it again. But it did strike me as sort of an intriguing set of issues. So, anybody want to argue that copy that it should be transferable? It is, after all. So, come on, you know, defend the status quo. That's going to be part of your job, right? Maybe not. Yeah?
I think it should be.
Right. Why?
I mean,
you can. They could. But what about the case? Suppose a company's going out, it's going bankrupt. They can their trademark is an asset.
Yeah, they can sell the trademark, but it has to go with the business.
What does the business mean?
So whatever they're manufacturing. So, like, for example, when Moses went out of business, they sold Twinkie, which included, like, the mark, and it also included the goodwill of the business and, like, any recipes that are associated with it. Whereas in Japan, you can actually hold them independently. So, like, for example, Converse is owned completely. There's the Converse mark that is owned by one company, whereas the actual business Converse is producing the shoes is actually owned by a different company.
But the mark is still going with the shoes produced by the company,
yeah,
no?
Yeah, well,
it's just one of them is paying the other to use it.
It's an importation issue.
Yeah.
Because American Converse is kind of important because it's complicated.
Yeah. But the let me say that there are a couple of arguments that you could make. I'm not sure if they're right. One of them is that insofar as the company sort of that's selling the trademark is going to stay in business, it wants goodwill, it wants people to say, well, maybe they're not making it anymore, but they didn't at least cheat us by giving it to some scam artist. That's a possible different argument, and one which I think is sort of interesting, is going to get into some of the other things we'll talk about, is think about the incentive to establish a good reputation. Because you could argue that if the reputation is not transferable, then you have a weaker incentive because you might stop using it, whereas if the reputation is transferable, then you have a stronger incentive, so therefore you make a good product and do good things and support it. And then the claim can be made, and this is going to get into one of the arguments about advertising actually, that the company that buys your trademark has an incentive to maintain that reputation. That it's, in effect, an asset they've got a sunk cost on. Now, it's true they could burn it up. They could say, well, we'll take advantage for a little while of the reputation and make really cheap, junky products. But if they paid a lot of money for it, and if it was worth the first company keeping on making good products, maybe it's worth theirs as well. So it's not absurd to have a transfer rule. It's by no means obvious that it ought to be, on that theory, that it ought to be. That it ought to be transferable, which it seems to me is sort of intriguing. Yes?
It seems weird that there's some marks that aren't necessarily the full name of a business.
Right.
Or some, they just relate to
right.
some sort of. So, for example, if I'm not mistaken, doesn't Lucasfilm, or I think Disney owns that now, but don't they get some cut from Android? Being named Android because it was originally
I would be surprised if they did, but I don't know, given that the term Android long precedes Star Wars.
Okay. Well, I'll research that more, but
yes.
It wasn't necessarily the name of like a business that they're selling the business with the mark, but it seems as if that or any other example, they would be licensing just...
You clearly can't... Yeah, no, you clearly can do that. I just think... That example seems implausible. Somebody was pointing out incidentally that Android, in the way it's normally used in sort of science fiction and future stuff, is really a mistake. Because Android in Greek means not just man, but man in the sense of male rather than the sense of human. That the term in Greek for human is anthropos, whereas the term for male man is andros. Whereas androids in science fiction can be both male and female, so that's really wrong. But as it was pointed out, anthropoid already has a meaning, and therefore did not occur to people as the term to use for that purpose. Which is also interesting in a way, because one of the things we really are talking about is the technology of language. All right, that's part of what's going into trademark, and that if there was only one possible term that could describe a particularly tasty beer, we would be unhappy with the first company to think of it using that term and monopolizing it. Whereas if there are 100 different equally arbitrary ways of saying my beer is tasty, we aren't. So we're really back to the depleting the commons issue, which we discussed a long time ago. To what extent are you taking away other people's options? Yeah.
So I'm not sure what you mean by the technology
of words. Of words. The question, I just gave an example. The question is, how easy is it to invent a word that will distinguish your product such that other people with similar products are still free to invent other equally good words? So if you think of a case where what we think of as an entirely arbitrary label, it sounds as though you can do it very easily, whereas as you move closer and closer to a descriptive label, it's getting more and more like something where if you use it, they can't, and therefore you've really harmed them by reducing that from the commons. And that's a, but there are other things as well, because what I, yeah.
Let's say, even if someone does have a trademark in something that, like a type of acquired technology, they don't have the secondary meaning, it's
yes.
not quite generic, but it's kind of on that borderline.
Yes.
Other people still are fair use to use the terms as long as you're not using it as a mark. So you can use it to like describe an aspect of a product, you just can't use it as your mark itself.
Yes.
So it's really only depleting the commons as far as marks are concerned, not necessarily as far as the language.
Well, except that the argument is that part of the point of a mark is a particularly compact form of language. Mm-hmm. Right? That when I say I'm producing a Cadillac product, that's somehow it's a little bit punchier and more effective than saying I'm using a high-quality product. One of the things which occurred to me in terms of a respect in which it is not restricting language as much as you might think is that it seems to me very common, if you look in the drugstore, that the house brand will say compare to. So what they're really saying is this is about the same formulation as the well-known brand name. And you know, sometimes it's not so easy. In fact, there is a nutritional product called Juvenon, which I started using at my father's recommendation because he knew the guy who was a Stanford professor who was originally responsible for it. And on further investigation, Juvenon contains two perfectly unpatented ingredients. It's very overpriced in terms of those ingredients. It's not famous enough, unfortunately, so I had to do some searching. I didn't actually find a jar that said compare to Juvenon, but I did find I have a jar that has something the same stuff in it and costs, I don't know, a fifth as much or something, which is what I now take. It's supposed, if I understand it correctly, the theory is that it's nutrition for the mitochondria of your cells, which is sort of interesting and weird and may or may not be true. But it's in general, my view is that things where there is some reason to think they're good for you, but not a very strong reason and no reason to think they're bad for you, it's probably worth taking the gamble. Take fish oil as well. Yeah.
Okay, so it wasn't Android, it's Droid.
Ah, that might be.
It is a licensed trademark to Lucasfilm, and they license it off
the Motorola. Yes, that I can believe, right? Droid would be, as the shortened version. Thank you. Suppose for a moment that we don't... Suppose we interpret trademark law as only covering protection against competing products. And suppose you have a well-known, very popular product with a high reputation, and it occurs to you that there is some other unrelated product which would benefit by that reputation. What might it occur to you to do? What?
Buy it.
Or produce it. Anybody noticed that you can get computer backpacks which have the Swiss Army label on them? Swiss Army knives have quite a good reputation. I don't know if any of you were in the relevant worlds, but they're sort of, for a long time, that's been the standard both of the kind of pocket knife that's got lots and lots of tools built into it, but it's also thought of as the high-quality version of that as opposed to sort of junkier versions. And apparently it eventually occurred, I think there are actually two different companies that own that particular trademark. Wenger is one of them, and I forget the other one, which I assume that they were both using knives for the Swiss Army 50 years ago or 100 years ago or something, is I assume what they came out of. But at least one of them, apparently, it occurred to them that it was a valuable label that they couldn't presumably, if I understand it correctly, they couldn't just go to somebody else who decided to use it and say stop, at least under the misleading theory of trademark, but they could start producing it themselves. All right. And once they're producing themselves, now nobody else can use it for that particular kind of good as well. So one of the issues that's coming in, And this ought to be beginning to remind you of the question of patents and improvements on patents, is doing things in-house versus out-house. That is to say, if you ignore the disadvantages of big firms, if you ignore the sense in which some things are better done by 10 firms than by one, you say, well, look, it's very simple. Once you've gotten this good reputation for your product, we don't need any dilution theory. We're just going to stick with misleading theory, but we're going to bring out all of the products which would be benefited by this label, and now we can stop anybody else from using the label for those products and so forth. And so that's sort of, it's an interesting thought about one of the things that's going on in these issues, because you do at least sometimes see, I've seen Porsche used for some product unrelated to motor cars too, I forget what it was, maybe a hard drive or something. And you can see that that's sort of one possibility, and then you would say, well, wouldn't it be simpler if that's what's going on, if we said, you own the trademark, anybody who is using it, not for your product, but to mean what you're using it for, to mean high-quality, high-tech stuff, which I guess is what Porsche is supposed to be conveying, you can enjoin them, so when somebody decides he wants to bring out a Porsche hard drive, they got to license the label. That's a possibility, but then, of course, we're back with the argument we saw before, but then the person who says, well, it never occurred to those idiots over in the automobile company, but I realized that the label Porsche would sell hard drives. I better not tell them and try to license them, because then they'll just take the idea and do it themselves. So you've got whereas if we say instead, no, it's only covered for automobiles, then that person can go around with his own idea. So it's really the same line of issues, of arguments, where in a certain odd sense, it's a sort of a joint production economic problem, where when you produce high-quality automobiles, I assume they're high-quality, they're supposed to be anyway, with the label Porsche, you are simultaneously producing the opportunity for someone else to produce hard drives with that label that people will buy, and so forth and so on. And then, of course, the next question is, yes, but should you be? Isn't that really just fraud on the consumers? Because who knows whether the hard drive is really as good as the automobile, or whether the automobile is as good as the automobile either. I have a vague feeling that Porsches, being a sports car type, probably are supposed to be in the garage half the time anyway. But that's... This, for reasons I won't go into, gets into the evolutionary biology of the differences between men and women. Men are sports cars because reproduction is a high-risk game for men and a low-risk game for women, since women can bear a fixed number of children and men either zero or lots, and therefore men are in the garage much more often. To think about designing something where doing very well is really valuable, and you're willing to accept failures in exchange. So that you end up with more men at both ends of distributions, that more men who are heads of companies and more men who are in prison or are lunatics or whatever the form of failure is. But that's a long digression, but it's actually an interesting way of thinking about the logic of evolutionary biology. Yeah.
Going back to the idea that somebody could create Porsche.
Yes. Did I think? Pretty sure that's real.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm not positive, but I think I've seen that.
Well, I think the current law has a solution to that, and it works fairly well, where the more unique the name, the higher protections.
Yes,
so it
right.
might be that, because it seems like by creating a Porsche name for cars, you create a lot of goodwill in that name. And then for somebody to just kind of take it, seems like you would lower the incentive for the original cars.
Yeah, well, that was the argument I was making before, but that's also the argument about transfer. That the fact that you can't transfer it if you go out of business also lowers the incentive to do it. That we're sort of mixing an incentive to do something and an informational function.
Talking about a situation where somebody simply just takes it without permission.
Yes, right.
Because it's such a
secret
product.
But their ability to take it without permission means you have a lower incentive than if they had to license it from you. Right? Just as if we have a relatively narrow reading of patent law and we allow my improved steam engine to go on the market without permission from Watt, that reduces Watt's incentive to have brought out the original steam engine. It's the same basic logic. All right? But on the other hand, do we really want the first inventor to have the control over it when other people come up with their own ideas for improving it, or do we want the first producer of this name? Because, I mean, part of the odd thing in some of these cases, this is where getting really from misleading to dilution, is that even when the customers know it isn't the same thing, that it's still the case that somehow, and that's why I'm part of the thing of technology of language, that it's sort of odd that words have denotations as well as connotations is the technical thing there, sort of a feel to the word, ideas that the word conveys.
But that word, I mean, I guess you made that point about a center spin Cadillac and high quality product.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that there isn't that much of a difference. And so why couldn't the hard drive producer just come up with a different name and say, I'm going to turn this into a high quality IDO?
They could, but that's going to take them time to develop the reputation. And it could be that they're trying to mislead people. It could be they're trying to make people think that the Porsche company makes them. Maybe it does for all I know. Of course, I don't know what the truth is. But it could also be that they're saying people have a good feel about things called Porsche, and even though they sort of rationally know that they don't know if it's any good, nonetheless they're going to be willing to give us the benefit of the doubt on this theory. That just look, think about the fact that part of the reason Apple can sell computers at higher prices than their competitors is they look good. All right? And at least for some consumers, there's sort of a feeling of this is a high-quality feel because they have engineered the newest version of the iMac so it looks really thin. It looks really thin because the edge is really thin and then gets fat as you go to the middle. But sort of looking at it, that's not immediately obvious, so it sort of feels like, aren't these, you know, really good engineers that they could squeeze a machine into no space at all, practically. And that is one of the things that affects people's reactions, I think.
Something like feel is less. I guess another way to put it is, instead of calling them Porsche, what if you call them luxury tech, you know, something like that? What's the real difference then? Because you're still saying, well,
But one of them is you are merely conveying information in the form of a claim, and the other is you are somehow making a claim in a way that carries some kind of an emotional weight. And I agree, it's sort of hard to make a clear, rational model of what's happening, and yet I think it's pretty clear that if you look at how people actually talk. Did I mention in this class or in the other one the Heinlein story? Where a guy who's a psychological warfare officer it's Robert Heinlein was one of the major science fiction writers of the 20th century. And there's one of his stories where there's a revolution going on against a theocratic government in America sometime, like the 21st or 22nd century. And two of the characters are officers from the army who have defected to the revolution. And one of them is the narrator, or the protagonist, at least, who's somewhat naive. And the other is a psychological warfare officer. And the psychological warfare officer is explaining to his buddy that it isn't what you say, it's how you say it. And his buddy says, well, you know, maybe that's true for uneducated peasants, but, you know, sophisticated people like us, just look at what the words mean. And the psychological warfare officer then says something to him. We're never told what it is. And the guy attacks his friend that has to be pulled off of him. And the warfare officer says, well, look, all I said was that you were the legitimate child of a legal marriage. But it was how he said it. And so Heinlein just leaves you to guess what the actual words were. But it is true that to some extent, you know, we aren't perfectly logical machines. I'm not sure we even could be. And that words do have these connotations as well. And sometimes they start out with those connotations. That's sort of one related question is, suppose we have a word which has no connection to the product, but which for unrelated reasons has positive connotations. Should I be allowed to get ownership of it? All right. I'm thinking of a real case, by the way. The word I'm thinking of is virgin. Because one of the odd features about 21st century world is that the actual importance of virginity is much lower than in most past societies. And yet you have Virgin Airways, you have Virgin Records, you have this word being used as a trade name because it somehow carries an emotional punch of sort of purity, roughly, something like that. So ought one to say, well, you're allowed to apply non-dilution principles, but only if the word isn't a word that somebody else would have wanted to use because of its good feel, even though nobody else was using it. All right, so that's a possible way you could go in this direction. Different point that occurred to me, one that isn't in the chapter, but I thought was sort of interesting. Suppose you go with the misleading the customer model of what's going on. Who is the real victim then of false trademarks?
Well,
In our order, yep.
But the customer or the original?
The customer, certainly. And the original is a little tricky, because after all, we don't feel that if someone persuades people not to buy your product by in other ways, even in ways that aren't very good, we don't feel as though you can claim to be a victim, right? Suppose that I argue, well, it's a little tricky. Sometimes it gets into the defamation law. But suppose I write a novel in which the bad guys are all using Porsches, and people decide they don't want to use Porsches as a result, or a movie would probably be more effective than that. You can think of various ways. Or suppose I make an honest argument which might be wrong. Suppose I say, let's take the real example, interesting example, which is the Wankel engine. A long time ago, somebody came up with an ingenious version of an internal combustion engine that's entirely different from the piston engines we all use. And for quite a while, that was a standard example of people who were saying, in effect, this is a better way of doing it, but because we're already committed to the existing way, nobody will do it. And I think some versions where the auto companies won't introduce this because they're afraid it would hurt them, or just where we've sort of invested so much in developing the cylinder. NSU in Germany brought out a Wankel car, tried to market it for quite a while, was ultimately gave up on it. Mazda then took it over. And I don't know if they're still making it, but for a long time, Mazda made a small sports car, which was, I think, the only car in the world that used a Wankel engine. And I think they eventually gave up, and what was going on was it was a very elegant design. It had a very serious technical problem, which they were never able to entirely solve, and that turned out to be enough. Suppose that you've got a case like that, and somebody writes a serious scholarly article arguing that the product is a bad product, arguing that if you buy these, there you're going to have to replace them in 20,000 miles. And suppose he's being honest, he's got real arguments, but he's wrong. I don't think you've got any legal case, even though you've lost reputation. So there's a certain sense in which defrauding you by selling you something that I claim is silver and it's really a mostly copper alloy really strikes us as hurting you in a sense in which lowering your reputation, even though it's painful, doesn't feel like an aggression in the same sense, because there's a sense in which your reputation is in other people's heads and you don't own their heads. And so from that standpoint, assuming you can say that the real victims are the consumers who are being misled, why do we have the laws we have? Well, I would claim exactly the same thing is true of defamation, that the real victims, when people say I'm an evil person, you shouldn't read my books, I'm not the real victim. I don't have a right to have you read my books. The real victim are the poor people who aren't reading my wonderful books because they believe this fraud. But they're a dispersed group of people. Each of them is losing 15 cents. They're not going to do anything about it. I have a concentrated interest. Therefore, I have an incentive to do something about it. So in both defamation law and trademark law, you can think of the law, as it were, making one person the proxy suitor for a bunch of others. All right? Makes sense? I should say this, in a way, connects into what we were reading last week. Because although the authors don't go into it, the Baldwin and Levine book, part of their implicit argument is that in the political market, concentrated interest groups beat dispersed interest groups. That in the political market, if there is some law, such as extending copyright, which helps three firms a lot and does a total injury larger than that to 100 million people, but 100 million people have no good way of getting together their resources and pooling them and bribing politicians to stop the law, whereas the three or four firms can get together and say, look, you chip in some money, I'll chip in some money. So that economists would think of it as that from the standpoint of the pro-copyright extension firms, the copyright extension is a public good. Not for the whole public, just for them. But they're still a group. Public goods can apply to small publics as well as large. From the standpoint of the rest of the population, the extension is a negative public good. But it's easier to produce a public good for a whole of four people than a public of 100 million people. And therefore, the political system tends to redistribute from dispersed interest groups to concentrated interest groups. I think that's fairly, and that's, I think, implicit in the Baldwin and Levine argument, even though they don't go into details. Yeah.
But going back to your comparison to defamation, which
yes.
But there's a little difference there, and I think in the order of reputation. So when a person experiences another product is confused with it, that it came from, maybe we'll see the Porsche again, but he has a bad hard drive, and he goes, well, I guess Porsche isn't what it used to be.
Yep.
that's a little different from, because you have some precedents coming directly from the court, whereas when we're talking about criticism in the way of defamation, then there's someone else's reputation, which is the speaker's reputation, going into that. So he might say, well, I don't really trust this guy, or maybe that guy is kind of, you know,
yes,
cool. And then so he gets hit.
Could be. I agree. It's not a perfect analogy, but I think that it has. I think it is interesting looking at the law, at least as an economist, that where are the cases where it doesn't quite make sense, and yet it makes sense for this reason, is it? And there are other. There are, one of my standard puzzles is the difference between the penalty for attempted murder and successful murder. Being a bad shot is not a moral virtue. And the alternative version of that is, why do we punish attempted murder at all? I aimed at you, I hit a tree, you're fine, the tree is fine, why is... And both of those, it seems to be interesting puzzles of why, if the law makes sense, maybe it doesn't, but I think in those cases it probably does in both of those, for why we do it that way. So, one of the issues that occurs just under the misleading thing is the issue of descriptive terms being trademarked. And there, I think the easiest way of seeing that really is the depleting the commons problem. The argument which says that, you know, if there were really 100 equally good descriptive terms for this, we won't care if you steal one of them and use that to identify your product. But if there are only 2 or 3, that makes it harder for other people to do it. So that really is a real issue. So, if I go back now in the direction of the dilution argument, the dilution argument now, as I understand it, is saying it isn't that people think that the Porsche hard drive is made by the Porsche company. It's rather that one of the reasons people buy a Porsche automobile is that they say, boy, my friends will think I'm a high-status guy, I've got a Porsche automobile, and we know what the feel is of that word Porsche. And when the quality of that goes down, that really makes people less willing to buy Porsche automobiles. When the quality of the word, not the reputation of the firm, literally goes down. And that sort of gets into the idea, it doesn't have to confuse the consumer, and maybe it doesn't have to be the same thing. Suppose that Lexus were a fraud. Lexus, not Lexus. Maybe at that point it would hurt the car company. I'm not sure it would, but you could imagine at least arguing that that things carry over. I want to go back to another one of the cases I thought was one of the good cases in the reading, and that's the Girl Scout poster. Because the argument from one side would be sort of like an ordinary IP argument. It would be, look, we spend resources creating a reputation. This reputation can be used in lots of different ways. Why shouldn't we collect the revenue from all of those? Well, one of the ways that the reputation of the Girl Scouts can be used is for a joke about a pregnant Girl Scout. So then the economist is tempted to say, well, if it's really true that the benefit of that joke more than balances the embarrassment of the Girl Scouts will license the mark. And then we say, well, we don't think they're going to. And doesn't that get us back to the whole question of parity? Why is parity fair use? We discussed this before. One possible argument, I'm not sure it's the right argument, one possible argument is the one that says people are irrational about attacks on themselves and therefore greatly overvalue and therefore won't give permission to do it even if economically they should. That's at least one possible story with that. And that's, again, in a way related to the whole Watt puzzle, which we started with a long time ago, why he didn't license it. Maybe because his feeling of ownership over the steam engine, somehow he gave an unreasonably high weight to. If Kodak owns the word Kodak, if we're thinking about it in terms of producing valuable words, we agree that Kodak owns the word Kodak applied to cameras you're selling. Why doesn't it own the word Kodak applied to cameras you're talking about? Why can't they say, if the New York Times wants to do an editorial about cameras and they are using our useful word Kodak in discussing the Kodak camera versus some other cameras, why shouldn't we be able to charge them a licensing fee for using this word that we created? The book takes it for granted. They're surely right legally. Yep.
Seems like a transaction cost would be
That's the argument that I made back in Law's Order, that the trouble with turning the English language into property is if there were no transaction costs, it would make a lot of sense. You'd have an incentive to create better new words, but that licensing your language gets really costly really fast. Now, in addition, of course, there's the further problem that one of the things you will use the word for is to say bad things about the company, and that then gets back into the criticism, parody, that set of issues, which again is really, in a sense, the Girl Scouts issue as well. Yeah.
But criticism makes the market more efficient, right? Because then it acts as a signal of the quality.
But how much more efficient? The argument always has to be we've got costs and benefits, and just showing there's a benefit isn't enough. We have to have some way of deciding whether benefits are larger than costs. And then
that combined with the transaction costs.
Yeah, that's the first, because the first approximation argument say, well, yes, the criticism is valuable to the readers. They'll pay for it. It's costly to Kodak. They will pay to stop it by not being willing to accept your licensing offer. And so we've got to somehow balance them. Then you need some reason why what they're willing the price they're willing to the price they charge for licensing somehow either that overrepresents the cost to them, or the amount they can be paid for licensing underrepresents the benefit to other people, in order to show that you can't just do a straight trade-off.
So when you're stacking kind of benefits and costs,
yes.
How do you deal with that? Because you could come up with a couple of things at a cost, but maybe five things are benefits, but they don't necessarily.
But the answer is that the ideal way of doing it is you have a well-functioning market in which costs and benefits are both reflected in prices, and the problem is only when you have arguments saying that isn't true, right? I mean, if you just think about the sort of standard way everything gets produced, the sort of standard system in a market with private property in exchange is that if I want to produce a pen, I've got to buy all the inputs, which includes material and labor and higher factory and so forth. To buy the inputs, I've got to pay their owners at least as much as they're worth in their next alternative use, or they wouldn't sell it to them. So I'm picking up the cost of moving all those inputs out of other uses. What do I get in return? I do my best to sell my pen for the highest price people will pay for it. Therefore, I'm getting a price which reflects the value. Therefore, I'll make it if it's worth making and not if I don't. And you need about a semester or a year of price theory to go through the details of the machinery in which that works, and to see that at least in the perfect competition case, where there are lots of pen makers, it actually works perfectly. And in the monopoly case, it works imperfectly for a bunch of reasons, because for one thing, the amount I get isn't the full value of the product, because some people would be willing to pay more, but I'm charging the same price to everybody. So that gets more complicated, which is, if any of you don't have time for a full course on price theory, my price theory textbook is up on my webpage for free, and you can just read it. But Hidden Order, which is the price theory textbook rewritten for the intelligent layman, is not up for free because I couldn't get my publisher to let me do it. So that one you have to pay for if you want to get it. It's probably a Kindle by now, I suspect. Don't know. All right, let me go on to talk about the question. Let me talk about trade dress sort of briefly. How is trade dress any different from any of these other issues? Why might we be more reluctant to say the shape of your bottle counts as a trademark than we are to say the arbitrary name you invented for your soda is a trademark? Yeah?
We talked about this earlier in class, but basically this public award for Porsche from Cadillac is less distinct. The boundary is more fuzzy.
Right. There's basically that. It's a lot easier to see that a particular sequence of six words is arbitrary than a particular shape is arbitrary. And that in general, the trade dress stuff is sort of a combination of function, of three things, function, aesthetics, and trade dress. Function, aesthetics, and message. And you'd like to cut out the message. And to some extent, that's true for trademarks in the sense that presumably some words really do resonate better than others. But it's a lot more true, I would think, for design. So again, go back to the Apple computer. If you make a computer that looks exactly like the iMac, only it's running Windows instead, part of what you're doing, and you say on it Windows or something, so you aren't fooling your consumers, but you are stealing the design, which is an aesthetically attractive design. Now, maybe Apple can protect that with a design patent, but if they do that, that's going to expire after a while, whereas the trademark doesn't expire, so you can argue that this is overlapping into that field. All right, let me go back to the question of advertising, because that's a question which isn't just limited to the trademark, but it's an interesting issue in general of why advertising exists. Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? And there's at least some playing with some of those issues, I thought. And sort of the easy part is informative advertising, and certainly that's one of the things that's going on, that people have ads and they say various features of their products, some of which are true, probably few of which are literally false, but some of which are sort of, you know, we say that our beer is made from pure spring water, and it's absolutely true, and so are all the other beers. We don't tell you that, and you can think of things of that sort. But other cases, you're giving real characteristics of the product. But then what else is it? Is advertising producing value in any way other than giving information? Because that's one of the questions that's sort of running through the readings on advertising, I think. Anybody? Yeah? And that's, and it might be a value to the consumer. That is.
Like Abercrombie, I mean, none of the models wear clothes, but they sell clothes. So they're producing an image of, like, good looking people. I don't know.
What's the company?
Huh?
What company?
Abercrombie
and Fitch, yeah.
I mean, it's an image that they're trying to produce. I don't think it gives the buyers any information about the clothes.
If I remember correctly, Abercrombie & Fitch was originally a company that specialized in clothing for people who went on African safaris and similar things. I think it was, I'm pretty sure that it was originally a sort of upper-class outdoorman clothing kind of company. And they then used the sort of status that that gave them to gradually spread into a more general clothing market, which is sort of an interesting case. But, yeah, what I was thinking of, I guess the Marlboro Man would be a famous example, but that there's a certain sense in which one of the things you're doing is making myths and selling them. So that if I say, you would like to imagine yourself to be a 1890s cowboy riding into the forest with your, you know, hunting deer and maybe herding cattle or something like that, and we will help you imagine that. At a very low cost, right? All you gotta do is smoke our cigarettes instead of somebody else's cigarettes. Well, that's a real product. Alright? This is related to one of the puzzles in public choice theory, which is why anybody votes. Alright? If you think about it, it's easy to prove that no rational person would ever vote. At least in any large election. Because you say, look, presidential election goes, it's gonna go plus or minus 5 million votes. It's more complicated because our system, but suppose it was a straight majority vote. What's the chance that my vote will change the outcome? Maybe 1 in 10 million, roughly. How much trouble should I go to for a 1 in 10 million chance of getting who I think is the better candidate? And yet, even to get that 1 in 10 million, I don't have to not only vote, I've also got to put a lot of time and energy into figuring out who's the better candidate, because half the people think it's the other guy. So in order to have an informed opinion, makes no sense at all for anyone to do that. Now, to some extent, the prediction is right, because you have what's called rational ignorance. If you... I'll try this class. How many of you know the name of your congressman? One. Right. Two. All right. I'm not raising my hand, notice. Even though I heard her on the telephone called up for some kind of thing, and I assume it was probably my congresswoman. Woman. And what I'm arguing is, you know, if you happen to be interested in politics, that's fine. We all have odd hobbies. But as a way of achieving objectives, voting for the individual makes very little sense. And yet, most people vote. And I have an explanation. And my explanation goes to the Marlboro Man. The explanation is that it's the same reason. Let me go back to it. What looks like a different question, but I'm claiming it's the same question. Why are sports teams, unlike most other firms, associated with universities and cities? And the answer is that part of the pleasure sports teams are selling is the pleasure of partisanship. The pleasure of not just watching and doing well, but of cheering for your guys. Well, both the city and the university give you a pre-made body of partisans who can identify with the team and say they're our guys. Every 4 years in this country, there is played out across the country a contest with the state of with the future of the world at stake. And you can not only cheer for your team, you can even play on your team for the minor expenditure of an hour going to the polls. Right. And I think that's a correct explanation of a large part of why people vote. That it's the same thing of it is an emotionally satisfying pleasure of partisanship, but it's not limited to voting. You also will argue with some of your neighbors, or probably you won't argue with your neighbors because your neighbors probably agree with you. But I was just walking to class this morning. I heard somebody saying something nasty about the Tea Party. My guess is that that person doesn't know anybody in the Tea Party. But saying to other people who also know the Tea Party are bad guys, aren't the Tea Party stupid people, lets you feel good about each other. You're part of the same team, as it were. And I bet there are people on the Tea Party who are doing precisely the same thing in the other direction. So all of these are ways in which you've got immaterial things linked to your product. So one of the things that advertising is doing is actually adding something that people actually value. In terms of image. And when you say, as I think one of the authors is implying, that you really shouldn't, there's something wrong about buying that, I then say, well, then why is it also wrong to go to movies and read novels? That after all, a large part of the reason for going to a movie or reading a novel is to imagine you're the protagonist. You're the person doing those heroic things, accomplishing those great things. That's exactly the same thing. It's a fancier version, it's a higher class version, but it's again selling you the pleasure of having certain imaginary experiences, as it were. Now, notice, by the way, point which is not made entirely clear in the readings, and maybe wasn't clear when they were being written, but you do actually, as a consumer, have a choice. That in many cases, I'm thinking of house brands in the grocery store, that in many cases, you can say to yourself, well, I can pay the price that covers the advertising, and I can buy Coca-Cola. Or I can buy the house brand of the equivalent product, which they cleverly enough, because I have, it's not, what I drink is Coke Zero, mostly. And how do I identify Coke Zero? Well, aside from the fact that it has all these things, it's in a very black bottle. Funny thing, the house brand that turns out to be their close competitor to Coke Zero, it's not the same trade dress, but it's black, right? Very clever. And they are clearly free riding on the information, but I don't think they're confusing. I think it's obvious enough that it's not the same thing. So I get that. I discover it, in fact, tastes just about the same. And so when they both happen to be available and it's a good deal cheaper, sometimes the Coke Zero is on sale, I'm perfectly happy to buy that one. So people really are choosing not in all cases, but to a significant degree, whether they want to pay the price associated with whatever non-material benefits they get, or if they think it's a higher quality, which sometimes it is, of course. That is, you know, there is the point that the generic drug may be the same chemical, but you don't know whether or not it's being compounded as carefully, all the rest of that. A different element, which goes back to something I was sort of getting into with regard to buying brand names, is the idea of bonding your future performance. So we tend to think of bank buildings as having polished marble fronts, as being sort of architecturally impressive. Arguably, the reason for that is that in the 19th century period of free banking, you wanted to make sure that the people who deposited their money with you weren't too worried that you would take the money and run. Well, if you spend a lot of money on an expensive building, you're going to lose all of that if you steal their money, and therefore you're less likely to do so. So you can think of any case where you are visibly spending money on establishing your reputation, that in one sense what you're doing is bonding yourself. You're now saying, it wouldn't pay me to do this if I was planning to take your money and run, whether as a bank or a commercial product. I must be in for the long term, therefore trust me at least until you discover the product's no good. So one can interpret advertising campaigns that one way of seeing them is that the customer, you want to be a new product in an area. The existing products already have a reputation. And one view of the advertising campaign is to make the reputation by persuading people it's a good product. But another one is to make the reputation by persuading people they must have a good product and they couldn't afford to do this advertising campaign. Because if it's a bad product, in a couple of months they're going to go out of business because nobody will buy it. So therefore I should try their product. So that is an alternative, I think, not implausible way of looking at one of the functions. Finally, I ought to tell a story which I got from one of my friends in the advertising business. And that is that there is sort of this common view, which you see reflected in the comments here, which I'm sure is not entirely untrue, that advertising sells products by appeals completely unrelated to the products. So you have a good-looking woman on the picture in some way. Then my friend's story is that the people in the advertising business refer to this as vampire video. And what vampire video means is that they remember the pretty girl and don't remember the product. And the story he tells is of some test in some state where there is a market with two major products. And one of them has a big advertising campaign with a sexy woman on the, I don't know what it was. And then they have a, they ask the people afterwards, do you remember which product the campaign was for? And 19% of them said they remembered, and 10% were right, and 9% were wrong. So that's why they refer to it as a vampire video. Now, I'm sure it must work sometimes, they wouldn't do it, but I think it may work less than people often assume. And I think we are just about out of time. We are, in fact, just out of time, according to my